Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. And today we have an exciting episode. We actually have Rupert Barksfield from one of my favorite insurance protocols, Amulet Protocol. So it's a very exciting, essentially Rust ecosystem-based insurance protocol. We actually been studying insurance quite a bit, and insurance is actually something that's kind of on people's minds these days. So I think it's very exciting, and would love to welcome Rupert to the Miko Bits Show. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell us a bit about first of all, like Amulet and like Amulet Protocol, like how do you see insurance and DeFi? Like, what problem does it solve?
Sure. So, first off, you did a great introduction on it there that I just heard. So there's not a huge bunch more, but I will reiterate. But the first DeFi insurance protocol on the Solana ecosystem, we're built in Rust for the wider Rust ecosystem, but yeah, starting on Solana. And I suppose the main reason for employing insurance, especially in crypto, is there are so many risks, and we are just one area where you can reduce those risks down a little bit. And I suppose the exciting thing about what we do is that, if you stake into an alternative protocol, or you have your capital perhaps in what you think is a stable coin, we insure against two events. One being a protocol being hacked and your crypto being stolen, or in fact, stable coin depegging. But as far as I know, that never happens. Hey, Miko.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's really important to kind of talk about obviously those two separate types of insurable events. I think your tongue is definitely firmly in your cheek about stablecoin depegging, kind of in the wake or aftermath of the UST Terra kind of cataclysm. So, I definitely do see that there's a huge interest in this idea of insuring stablecoin depegging. I think one of the things that kind of came up today was sort of TRX / Tron, and I think USDD, which is another potentially, I think it's an algorithmic stablecoin, and I think in a way, I think the market is really looking right now to stress test assets, right? So, and I think obviously in the wonderful Andrei Krania test and production mindset, these so-called stress tests are actually like live with real money. So, it's an interesting time.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, it's a pretty terrifying time as well for those who are new to the market.
And did you say terrifying or terrifying?
I was going for the prior, but the latter sounds more apt. Yeah, it is a scary time for for folks coming into the market. Especially when, actually a great point. Terra had a protocol on it running called Anchor, and I think still to this day, when you go onto Anchor's website, its very first words are better savings. Now, people associate savings with safety and somewhere where you can put your money and it's going to be safe, and that unfortunately is simply not the case when that safety net is held in a stablecoin of which that could depeg. And not understanding the underlying factors in DeFi is a huge risk. And you wouldn't do it going into a bank, and yet in DeFi and in the wider crypto sphere, it's kind of a regular and expected occurrence for you to not understand what you're necessarily going into.
Yeah, so I think insurance is actually a really amazing and wonderful category of product. I think, these days when people are seeing, wide losses on incidents, right, on things like depegging incidents or hacking incidents, as you mentioned, right, these incidents really deserve what I consider to be professional scrutiny, right? And the professionals should scrutinize them in a way where there is some kind of monetary sort of incentive for them to get it right, right? So you know, when we think about insurance, that role is played either by a centralized or decentralized actuary, right? And that word is kind of a description of a function, right? So it could be a smart contract auditor. It could be a gray hat hacker. Like, there's many different actual, potentially even decentralized humans that could, you know, participate in an actuarial function, right? But I think the mindset behind doing that is to actually have very, very well-positioned people with very, very significant financial interest, basically underwriting or backing something that then makes it safer for people who are maybe just more like apes. So I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I totally agree, to be honest, that, you know, to have a functionality where people are able to feel comfortable because of those folks that are looking at a protocol and recognizing the risks involved, and applying a very simple metric to say, okay, this is risky and this isn't so risky, and essentially insurance provides that function, and certainly in the short term, until we've perhaps built out a few more functions in the wider Web3 ecosystem. But if you take a protocol of like what we're doing, you know, we vet and audit every platform that we look at before it goes onto our own protocol, and before we allow anybody to buy an insurance product from it. And we do that for two reasons. A, we don't want to be caught, you know, looking at projects that are probably less clean, so to speak, and that, you know, there are plenty of those in the ecosystem. But equally, you know, we've got to be careful about what we are backing ourselves, what we are putting our stakers capital to work on. And so, you know, if we're pricing something that is a particularly low cost for a user to buy as an insurance product, it's probably because we feel very confident around the risk factors in said protocol. Likewise, if we are pricing higher, it's probably because we are less confident around that particular protocol. Now, there are other factors involved, but that, in broad strokes, that's really what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you reason about this sort of from the perspective of risk and professional actuary, right, what you're really doing is you're sort of premium pricing, right, and that people can then infer, you know, that you as sort of a professional organization, you know, have, you know, a financial interest in getting it right, right? Because obviously, if you collect, you know, very, very small premiums, and then you have to pay very, very large payouts, you know, you won't last long, right? So, you know, I think that provides it's almost a staking mechanism, right? That people who are kind of following can be seen as, they can see you as almost like a staking and slashing provider, right? In the sense that if you get your actuary wrong, then you can suffer ill effects. People, that's the reason to believe, right? Which is that your skin is firmly in the game.
Yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. We're fully in the game. And yeah, we've kind of come out of the gates. I mean, I don't know how much your viewers are aware of Amulet, but we are quite new into the game. We started developing out the platform in November, and we'll actually be releasing it in September of this year. And despite the fact we're relatively new in the sphere in terms of our own protocol, we come from a real background of actuarial science, as well as backed from other folks within inside the DeFi industry. And we really do take a very strong viewpoint on certain protocols and the other, and we will back well away from the ones that we think are there's any sort of risk, because we've got to protect everybody in the industry, and that includes ourselves.
Yeah, that's really good. So I think we'll touch back onto sort of design and actuary, centralization, decentralization, insurance, stable coins. Sure. We're going to drop back into the kind of content space. But what I wanted to do is shift a little bit of gears because our audience is always interested in the humans, right? So we'd love to kind of learn a little bit about kind of yourself and your background. You know, in particular, one of the topics I'd love to touch, kind of having knowing a little bit about your background, you know, is I'd love to talk about sort of these bearish conditions, you know, and how kind of smart operators navigate within these kind of conditions.
Well, as you probably know, and I suspect where you're going with the question is that this is not my first rodeo in a bearish market, and I think. Really with what it's probably great to tell some of the viewers is that through I joined crypto in about 2016. So up until that point, I've been building businesses, you know, most of my life. I had an opportunity to work a bit with Google as well and some of the amazing American sports brands as well, such as the NBA and NFL. And then, you know, kind of rock and rolled back into my startup career. And like all startup founders, you have great highs and great lows. And I've been around them all. But my entrance into crypto was a particularly rocky start where I bought some assets in 2016. I rode them all the way to the peak in 2018. And just before the peak in 2018, I actually started to my first crypto business. And so that was around late 2017. And in 2018, obviously we the crash right down and had to pivot. You know, we pivoted we had what was it was a business called the Crypto Crowd, and we utilized crowd wisdom to identify a portfolio of assets and then sell that back to our community. Very community driven, very community focused, and it was a great business, and actually still is to this day. But I'll tell you how we got to that point. In 2018, we had to pivot to regulated assets. We just couldn't drive the business or raise capital around a company that had anything like A, crypto in the title, or B, any association to the crypto world, especially here in Europe, where investors are already very risk evasive. It's unlike what I like to think of the Palo Alto gung-ho attitude.
Yeah, that's our neck of the woods.
Yes, risk averse is the name of the game in VC in Europe, and yeah, the check sizes are smaller and all the rest of it. But in any case, pivoted away into regulated assets, and that's how we were able to save the business, save our employees, save their families, and all the rest of it. And they and whilst that was a good decision business wise, from a, you know, I suppose a heart position, I felt that we were tearing ourselves away from the market, which was. Which was a sad thing to do, but sometimes you have to do this in order to move forward. Anyway, coming around to the exit of that, I was really focused on DeFi. I rode through DeFi summer and learning all of the new protocols that were coming through, all of the new chains that were coming through, and web, you know, come around to kind of July of last year when I exited out my previous company, which by that stage was called Pink. I was dead set that I wanted to work on a DeFi protocol, and I had this itch for insurance and how badly insurance was done. And not only that we had this great opportunity in DeFi to do insurance differently. So is this a good point that I can talk about how different Amulet is? Is that okay? Can I?
But what I would love to do, and I love the passion, you know, so first off, I'd love to actually just interject here and normally this is at the beginning, but I've completely forgotten, which is, this is where I, actually, declare, that my fund, Gumi Crypto's Capital is invested in Amulet. So it just a disclosure point. So, you know, we on the show, we love to be transparent about disclosure, make sure everybody knows, you know, which side of the bread things are buttered and whatnot. But, you know, I also wanted to say that, just a little quip, which is, you know, I think you were describing DeFi summer, right? And I think recently I saw some wag on Twitter call this one DePeg summer. I thought it was pretty good. Anyhow, yeah, I would love to hear kind of what makes Amulet different, right? So that's exciting.
Yeah, DPEG Summer. That's a brilliant one. Actually, I'm going to remember that for the next podcast. But the so really, what differentiates Amulet to all other, not only DeFi insurance protocols, but all other insurance, you know, companies, is that we're changing a model that is over 300 years old. So in insurance, it is a two-sided model, and this hasn't changed for, I think it was Lloyd's that originally came up with this circa 1700 and something. And the essentially, you've got on the one side people who have large amounts of capital, or in our, you know, in DeFi world, it's now stakers. And then on the other side, you've got people who want to take out policies. Now, that system works absolutely fine. Everybody's happy with that system. There's no problem until there is a claim. And when you have to pay out a claim, you have to make a decision which side or the other you're going to disappoint. If you pay out the claim, obviously the policyholders are happy, but you disappoint your stakers. Yep. If you don't pay out the claim, the reverse is true. And ultimately, that leads to a downward spiral of discontent and disassociation with the platform. And then... Sure. Ultimately, the stakers are unhappy. So how do you fix that? Is the short question. And with DeFi, we have the best opportunity we have ever had. And what Amulet does, we take stake capital, we put it into a proof of stake validator that generates a yield, and it's that yield that we use to pay out our policyholders. So at no point are we ever having to make that decision. We've always got a yield, and we're always protecting staked assets. So the only thing the stakers are risking is the top part, the top yield of your staked assets. And so that's how we differentiate it. And it's all enabled by new technology. Yeah, in our case, the Solana blockchain, and you know, many more to come.
Yeah, that is tremendously exciting. And, you know, it's great to see kind of advancement. Obviously, this is a very age-old industry. I guess one of the things I would love to kind of direct your focus on is the question of sort of actuarial, right? Which is, you know, it feels like with the current mechanism that Amulet kind of are making, you know, the primary decisions around these kind of actuarial considerations. Like, how do you see sort of the near term, present and future of actuary, right? Because my view is that ultimately, you know, the people who are best able to evaluate, you know, I think first off kind of DPEG events, and the second off kind of events related to hacking, right? Those may be obviously very different people. So I'm wondering how you kind of get the best of the best and how you see the future of actuary.
So, It's a very good question. It's not a straightforward answer. So let me take you on a little journey. But essentially, there are two sides to the actuarial process, or at least the process in Amulet's world, whereby you've got the listing side of things, and then you've got the claims and the payout side of things, and looking at those particular events. So on the listings side of things, initially we are assessing projects internally in-house. We have our own auditing team that we use to audit smart contracts that we are looking at, and looking at the underlying algorithms beneath the algo stable coins and so on and so forth, and assessing a risk, working with our actuaries in-house, and applying a risk score and fee associated with that. Now, I don't believe that that's going to be the future of what we're going to do. We have to scale this out as a business as we grow. But in the short term, medium term, this works as a bit of a stopgap. And over the long term, we want to leverage our community and our community of partners, moreover, to actually provide that auditing and actuarial service or understanding of a protocol for us. Now, on the flip side to that, you've got the claims side of things. So a claim comes in, and no one claim is necessarily the same. We found this out with some of our friends in the DeFi industry, DeFi insurance industry already, that when claims come in, they come in from all sorts of different angles, and they come in a wide variety of what a person thinks is a claim, even though the contract is exactly the same. So the reason I say that is that essentially every claim still needs to have a bit of a human element involved in it. So what we do right now is that we assess the claim, we make a decision, and then we allow our community to assess the claim, and they make a decision. Now, if we're both in the agreement, the claim gets paid out. If we're both in disagreement, it doesn't get paid out. If there's any sort of imbalance of agreement or disagreement, then we bring in a third party DAO to become the jury and make that final decision for us. And that's what we think is the fairest way on more complicated cases. Now, on something like a stablecoin DPEG, that's a pretty simple case. And the only thing that needs to be verified is whether or not you had the asset or not, which of course is all on chain and all traceable. So we actually do automatic payouts for things like stablecoin DPEGs. We still have the final tick box, yes, this is okay to go before it, you know, money floods out of our treasury, but it still it automates the whole process to say, this person is okay to be paid out. Tick box, let's go.
Yeah. So you're talking about basically some kind of a parametric based on oracles? Like, is that the kind of construct?
Exactly that. Yeah. So we use Oracle data. And we use a few different oracles because that's a huge point of potential failure and hacking and yes. Gaming the system. So we use a few different oracles and combine those together, taking the average of all of them to work out whether or not a stablecoin has in fact DPEGged.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting, right? Because broadly speaking, one of my quips around UST is that stable or pegged assets, stablecoin is actually a bad name, right? Because stablecoin UST was provably unstable, right? So like, yes. To me, like there really aren't any stable coins, as I've long said. There are only pegged coins, right? So
yes.
Pegged coins actually have two values that they're sort of magnetically attracted to, right? They're magnetically attracted to the peg value and to zero, right? And yes. And they have kind of what I call a built-in death wish, right? Because they desire yep. to be one of those two states, right? So to me, because of the nature of something of that, you know, because of the nature of kind of pegged assets, it seems pretty not that hard, you know, and I definitely appreciate your desire to have multiple different oracles, right? Because obviously yep. the attack vector is to create like a lying oracle and to kind of fake a DPEG and then get a payout, you know, in correct. Some cases, like, and I like your fail safe, right? Because, you know, if there is such an attack, you know, via some kind of very temporary flash lending attack or where the peg comes off and then it comes back on again, right? Like yep. there may be some really interesting, you know, attempts to sort of flash lend DPEG and then get an insurance payout and then be rich, right? So like that's a vector, right? So I like having kind of at least a gating mechanism where it's like, you know, like what is really the nature of this, right? Because in the real world, you actually have that. And something like that is absolutely determinable to be insurance fraud, right? Which is that
yeah.
the attacker is the insurance holder, you know? So in a sense, it's a little bit like, you know, you take out a life insurance policy on your spouse and then you like murder them, right? Obviously that's a, you know, kind of a horrible concept or story, but like that's essentially what we would be talking about here, right? So in a sense, I mean, there does need to be a fail safe against that kind of behavior.
I was just talking about our life insurance policy with my wife earlier, and she wants to increase ours. Do you think there's an impending life attack?
That's good.
On its way.
There was a crazy case in the news where I think someone was a book author of a book called like How to Murder Your Husband and Get Away with It or something like that.
Yeah.
And she, I think she was convicted of murdering her husband and trying to get away with it. So I think that was the recent news. So it was definitely like, I think one of the tips I'd like to provide in case you're planning such a thing is to not write a book called that. I just feel like it's a little, maybe, I don't know, not the best cover up.
A little leading to the,
I'm not sure if I have the facts of the case, but, you know, I just, I just thought it would be entertaining. So very curious though about this, right? Which is, I think to me, one of the things that I'm definitely a little hesitant around is decentralizing more on the claims adjustment side, right? Yeah. But I am quite a lot more kind of interested in decentralization around the actuary side. So, you know, I think
yeah. those are 100%. I mean, look, the trade-off always when building a DeFi company is what is centralized and what is decentralized, and where does the regulatory risk lie, and where does the user risk or demands lie, and it is a very hard path to walk. I mean, yeah, looking at our company, I'm out here, I'm very visible, I'm very, you know, I put all my information online and people can see me. That puts me in a huge regulatory dangerous place. I am associated with this project, right? And if should the authorities want to come after us for what we've ever done, that is me on the line and my family and our welfare that I am putting
they'll
at risk.
They'll be watching this show. authorities will be, yes, you know, trying to figure out what it is that you said.
I'll be waiting for me as soon as I land in America. The SEC will pick me up. I mean, look, I hope, you know, on a very serious note.
They actually served Do Kwon actually at Messari Mainnet on an escalator. The SEC actually served him, which is, was really just, I don't remember the details, but they definitely accosted him at the event with lawyers, and they served him papers. Far ahead. This was months and months. And this, I think this was last year's Messari Mainnet. So this is like way past, you know, way early, right? This is way before any of this other recent rumbling.
So if I ever get a question saying, are you Rupert Marksell, the question is, who's asking? Is that the I have to question every single person that will potentially ask me that.
There you go. At a crypto conference.
Yeah. I mean, look, on all serious note, I hope that never happens. And whilst we can joke in jest about it, it is something that we concern about. But this is the whole, thread of decentralization and centralized, is that we want to be able to be as decentralized as possible. But there are huge forces at play pushing us back into a centralized world. Well, for us, you know, when we look at things like regulation, we look at those forces at play and KYC and all the rest of it, we will do what is required, but we also want to do it in the right way. Like, great point around KYC is like, I don't need to know all the details about you, Miko. I just need to know whether or not you are allowed to buy my product. And so you don't, I at no point should you be putting all of this information into my servers. Like, there's no point to that. And I,
yeah.
Those sorts of things matter an awful lot to me. And so coming back to that decentralization question.
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking quite a lot about decentralized identity. I don't want a rabbit hole here, but I do want to share with my audience that, like, you know, we do think that the idea of privacy preserving, kind of mediation points around self-sovereign identity that are kind of largely decentralized through things like multi-party computation, you know, are kind of very relevant for these types of use cases. I think there's actually two layers of privacy preservation. One is basically the idea of using multi-party computation for almost like a base layer kind of, obfuscation, you know, and then I think on the second layer, there's probably actually a zero knowledge layer, right? So, you know, within the zero knowledge layer, then, you know, because in the base layer, you have foundational data, right? So foundational data is used for proof and attestation. So for example, my fingerprint or my face ID or even government ID, you know, like an image of government ID, all of that deserves protection via things like MPC. And the reason that's so important is that if you have a centralized database filled with the data, hackers can take the whole database. Like, they can just take all of that primary data. And that's one bad outcome, right? But then if you use that data in a decentralized mechanism through something like privacy preserving multi-party computation, then you can actually still make individual attestations, right? But at that point, if you have zero knowledge, then what you can have is you can have like, well, this person has an ID, a government ID, right? They have, you know, the fingerprint shows that they're the same person from the last session, right? So you can definitely make assertions without actually providing the things themselves, right? That's the second layer of protection, which is sort of a zero knowledge layer. You can say something like, this person is over 18 without saying exactly when their birthday is, you know, which might be used as a security question, you know, when you're accessing your bank, like, what is your birthday or these things like that, right? I mean, you know, people actually have that on Facebook, but, you know, but what I mean is, you know, these are kind of the future states, you know, and the potentially the future ideal states for, you know, cryptographic identity. But I didn't want to rabbit hole too much there, but it's definitely a exciting, nerdy, fun topic. So one thing I'd love to do is kind of get a sense. So you were talking about like, you know, roadmap. Obviously, you're talking about, you know, shipping this year. You know, so I guess what I'd love to do is kind of get a sort of a feeling of like, you know, milestones, like what's going to get built when.
Cool. So, I'm very pleased to say that it's already all built. It is currently in testnet at the moment, and it's going through smart contract audit, or the first set of our smart contract audits. Because although we have our own auditors in house, and I've got our incredible dev team, we still need to have a third set of eyes, or fourth or fifth, to really verify what we're doing. So that's the auditing process that we're going through at the moment. Should get the results of that back in August, and then the final push to get the platform live for September. That's our focus right now. We may come a little bit early, actually. I know it'd be incredible in software development. But
it sounds like you're racing Vitalik for the date of the merge, right?
So yeah, 100%. Yeah,
you're trying to see who's going to win.
I'm not certain that Vitalik knows about us yet, but I'm definitely racing.
maybe you'll get there first. So I'm very curious about. So we did talk a little bit about DPEG events. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about security in terms of smart contract risk, right? So in a sense, like that's a tremendous area of risk. I think that's a big one. So talk about smart contract risk.
Yeah, so I think a great example of this is probably the Ronin hack this year, whereby hackers got into the system, and it's still not very clear exactly how they got in. But what they did is they started moving funds out, and it was about 7 or 8 days before the internal team.
I heard it was actually key compromise, which is kind of something that's not actually internal to the smart contract, but rather it's actually a business process.
Correct. Yeah. So the point I wanted to make about it was the fact that the parameters around security weren't really set up so that the team didn't recognize that this compromise had happened until many days later. I think it was 7 or 8 days later. Meanwhile, the hacker had gone straight through Tornado Cache, and it was away in the wind. Right?
There was a great. So first of all, it is reputed that credible sources repute that actually the Ronin hacker is actually either Lazarus or a second North Korea state actor tied hacking agency, which I thought was quite interesting. I think the other thing that was really, I think, kind of notable about this is people were joking about the lag. They were joking about on Twitter, they were joking about how the hacker had hacked and then it took days, right? And I think that the joke was that the hacker had shorted the token, right, expecting it to fall, being hacked, and then that the joke was that the hacker got liquidated, right? Because the joker this is going to crush the token price, and then the hacker lost all their money, you know, shorting it because it didn't respond, right? So it's amusing. I don't know how true any of this was. Probably not true, but
yeah,
funny to contemplate.
I would hesitate. I guess probably not. The especially when you've got that much. I think it was, you know, roughly $645 million or so in total assets that he had control of at that stage. So
it makes Virgil Griffith's visit to North Korea maybe even a little more kind of maybe alarming seeming. I mean, you know, I think it's a, you know, North Korea state actors. I mean, it's fairly known that there are state actors doing hacking.
Doing nefarious stuff.
That's alarming, and it suggests a pretty high degree of sophistication.
Oh, yeah. No, I truly believe that North Korea in particular are an extremely advanced state, given what they pump out just by throwing some missiles up into the air. That's pretty pretty advanced. But anyway, coming back to smart contracts.
Yeah.
My concern around that, like the Ronin hack in particular, was the team hadn't put into place like simple large movement trackers. Like if you see a large movement of funds from our set wallets, we need a trigger. We need to be notified. We need a you know, just put some, and these are very basic functions, which normally in any financial system you would automatically do. Now, it's nothing against the team of the developers or anything like that. I'm sure they are all absolutely incredible, but they're not coming from a security or a financial background. You know, they're coming from games development. They're implementing these tools to enable the game to be better, to be, you know, play to earn. It's these exciting, you know, new features, and yet these are the guys that are looking after hundreds of millions of dollars. And so it's not unsurprising that hackers can find these easy loopholes to work their way into.
I think you're describing what I would characterize as a third layer, right? And what I mean by a third layer, right, which is that the first layer defense is in some ways, I mean, obviously maybe there's a fourth layer, right? Because the team itself who built the thing is definitely a first layer, right? But you mm-hmm. could definitely consider auditors, external auditors, you know, like the Quant Stamps of the world or Certic or Trail of Bits or, you know, all the Open Zeppelin, all the well-known reputable auditors. That's kind of a second layer, right? But I would say that the third layer could actually be something like bug bounty, right? So, you know, I'm an angel investor in Immunify. So like the bug bounty layer is distinct from the audit layer, right? In the sense that it's sort of black to gray hat actors that are sort of helping to find and fix bugs, you know, in exchange for these very sizable bounties, which have been paid out.
Yeah.
So we've seen millions in bounties paid out, protecting billions in assets. So like, that's nice to see, right? It's nice to see, you know, gray people, black hats choosing to go gray and earning, you know, like that's 100%. Good. It's, you know, cause it definitely is maybe an order of magnitude less damage and, you know, and it's a huge reward for going gray hat, right? So that's nice. But to me, like you're describing the insurance layer, and I think the insurance layer feels like the last line of defense, right? It feels like, you know, hey, you know, things have already gone bad, right? Like in a sense, all the other layers are kind of like, let's prevent things from going bad. But like, you know, in a sense, because the history of cybersecurity has been a ever increasing kind of arms race between attackers and defenders, it feels like it will be a continuously never ending kind of we'll see more and more interesting, sophisticated attacks, you know. So I think that the idea of insurance is like profound and necessary, you know, and I think it's I think it's going to be actually very big. So that's my view.
Well, that's certainly my view as well. I mean, look, just you know as well as I do that the insurance sector inside DeFi is extremely undervalued. We have around about 20 or so players inside the DeFi insurance industry. There's probably only about three or four of those that are really worth looking at. And if you look at the sort of revenues they generate, they're up in the top 30, you know, in terms of all DeFi insurance protocols, in terms of all Web3 protocols. So you take off, the exchanges, and you're left with people like Axie, you're left with people like OpenSea, but then you've also got people like InsurAce up there. You've also got people like Nexus Mutual.
Yes.
And these guys are generating huge revenues, massive revenues back into the space. In fact, last year alone, it was about $24 billion or so that we generated as an industry in terms of revenue. $12 billion of that was stolen, as a matter of fact. But the not $12 billion of the revenue, but certainly $12 billion of hacks last year. And yet out of that, you've got insurance, which is kind of killing it. And yet we're the smallest, most undervalued sector in the whole of DeFi.
I would say this, right? Which is that in a sense, like we've been in a sort of a yield chasing mood, right? Mm. And I think that the yield chasing mood is a mood of what I would call degeneracy, right? And the mood of degeneracy is effectively that if you can print money and emit money quickly, right? Yeah. So it's printing an emission, you know. So when you think about printing an emission, you know, you are talking about kind of like sort of the Terra UST model, right? In a sense, it's a game of chicken, right? It's a very dangerous game, you know. And as kind of degeneracy, it definitely gets part of the game is attracting attention, right? So the ability to get everyone, because it's riveting to watch. Like it's, you know, in a way, it reminds me of rebasing tokens, you know. So if you go back to the YAM token, which is way back, you know, and obviously YAM derived its rebasing construct from Ampleforth, right? So if you go back into the history of the rebasing tokens, those are all very good attention getters, right? Because everybody's kind of, you know, trapped in this kind of watching the rebase and, you know, these incredibly fraught moments, right? But I would say that, like, to me, I think this kind of new kind of, I would say we have to kind of rebuild decentralized finance, right? And I think really coming at it from the perspective of value, right, is, I think, meaningful, right? So to me, like, the world deeply understands the value of insurance. And I think that when things are going badly, they understand it even more, right? Like they have, you know, so to me, like, if we're going to rebuild decentralized finance, you know, from the bottom up and from the ground up based on value, you know, I think insurance is a wonderful thing. The other thing I wanted to comment about from a kind of market sector perspective is, you know, my fund, Gumi Crypto's Capital, you know, we're definitely excited about derivatives, you know, which is in the traditional finance world, kind of an extremely large segment, right? But, you know, and our fund has, you know, really interesting investments in the area, including things like Vega Protocol on the DeFi side, you know, and we also have Delta Exchange on the centralized side, right? So we have CeFi and DeFi derivatives kind of exposure, right? But the thing that I think is really interesting is that there's a strong adjacency between insurance and derivatives, which is that they're both kind of very risk-centric financial products, right? And that the thing that I think is fundamentally different about them is really the kind of sort of the actors who are the main participants, I think are just different actors, right? So if you look at derivatives, it's really very much these sort of professional hedge funds, and, you know, that derivatives enable professional hedge funds to hedge, right? Yeah. Whereas in a way, the idea of insurance, of course, is just a radically different thing. But in a way, like, all a hedging action is it's a form of insurance. Right. Hedging is insurance, because hedging is basically like, oh, you know, I think X, but in case Y happens, like, I also have a response, like I created a response to that. Right. So, you know, to me, the reason why I think insurance will be bigger than derivatives, right, in the sense of, like, bigger, because if you look at the relative sizes of things in traditional finance, insurance is cosmologically large and derivatives is actually even bigger. But if you look at the derivatives that have worked in DeFi, the derivatives have largely been what I call casino derivatives, right? Yeah. Which is that it's sort of Deribit, like 100x Bitcoin, you know, or Delta Exchange 100x Bitcoin, you know, which are not sophisticated risk actors. It's just apes becoming even more apish, right? And in a sense, like, it's either, I mean, casino may be a little bit too pejorative. It may be asymmetric information actors. Right. So, so if you know something's going to happen to Bitcoin, you know, you can actually do a derivative action against that. So that's not aping, right? That's actually asymmetric information. And that does exert presence in the market. But what I'm really saying to you is that I think that the problem with DeFi is that there aren't fundamentals, right? And the problem is that there aren't people shaping risk based on fundamentals. They're not doing that, right? They're not doing it because really the whole thing, once you do any DeFi, the amount of risk is so profound that the idea that you're like, oh, I'm in DeFi and I'm hedging this very small risk based on my fundamental analysis. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Like, you're not doing that. Like, that, like, doing that doesn't make sense, right? So I feel like in TradFi, people are doing all kinds of things. They're doing energy market derivatives. They're doing telco market derivatives. You know, they're doing financial, you know, exchange FX derivatives, right? But all of that is based on, like, really deep fundamental modeling, right? So my point is I think insurance. So if you look at the pie, TradFi will have a pretty large derivatives, large insurance, you know, and large primary market. But I think in DeFi, it's going to be a much larger insurance and a smaller derivatives market. That's my argument.
It's an interesting point. I mean, personally, from my point of view, if we could just move the pie a couple of points on the amount of insurance, and that would blow us out of the water in terms of, volume and growth. I mean, to give you some numbers that might put this into context, is about 3.5% of the global population that have touched crypto right now, versus the masses majority who have touched traditional finance. Now we take that 3.5%, and there's about 2% of that. In fact, I think there's a little less at the moment that have actually touched DeFi in insurance. So if you move the needle of the amount of people that have touched crypto by a point, that exponentially, that's masses amounts more people that are able to access DeFi insurance. Now, if we're able to move that needle as well, then the upside is gigantic. I mean, it's genuinely from a fairly layman perspective of myself, it is so huge, the opportunity and the size of this market. It's kind of incredible. And I'm not saying that as a salesperson to just push Amulet. This is purely from a perspective, like, we've just so early on, and be it a derivative market, be it a primary market, be it an insurance market, we've just got so much opportunity of growth. It's incredible. And that's what draws me in continually to DeFi. It's always what draws me back to DeFi when I'm feeling a little bit worried about the bearish market. But that is primarily where we want to go.
I mean, for us, like, we definitely want, I mean, there's already been this kind of like DeFi 2.0 thing that's been discussed, yeah, right? And the ship has sailed on that brand. Like, it's sort of like, no, that wasn't really a thing, you know? And obviously, you know, recently Jack Dorsey announced, you know, Web5, which is sort of like his very kind of, I guess, trolling the trolls kind of, you know, Web3 to Web5 kind of thing, you know? But to me, like, I don't have a name for it, but I think we are rebuilding DeFi, right? And to me, I think we're rebuilding it kind of in a post Terra DeFi, right? So I think we need to, you know, and to me, the thing that is happening is that there are these kind of so-called stress tests, or effectively like teardowns of kind of sort of the no value zones, right? Like, if you're degen money printing, right? Like, degen money printing is sort of an emissions, isn't really a thing. Like, that's just random money printing, you know, so you can just make a new thing, Rupert coin, and then just, you know, emit, and people will come collect it for free in an airdrop or whatever, right? So the whole thing is kind of like, that can just die, right? But there is still base value. Like, for example, like, one of the services that makes tons of sense to me is borrowing and lending. That makes sense to me. Like, I'm like, oh, well, some people need money, some people have money. And like, if you think about time preference, right, the time value of money, right, the people who have money will always get yield, right, because of the time preference, right? So when I think about, is that valuable? Like, if you've ever, you know, earned yield from lending, then it's valuable to you. And if you've ever needed to borrow money for any situation, it's valuable to you, right? So to me, I look at stuff like that. I look at stuff like insurance. Like, you know, if you've ever had, if you've ever collected on any insurance, probably the likeliest scenario is that you've collected on some car insurance claim, right? That something's happened to your car. Like, if you've lived long enough, something has happened to your car, right? And you probably were able to collect, or, you know, maybe not. But like, my point is that, like, that's real value. People want that, right? And they, you know, obviously, like, in my state, in California, like, you have to have it, you know, and at a minimum, you have to pay for the other guy's car, right? You know, which is part of that system, right? But the point, you know, so it's, in a way, it's not kind of like, I want to buy it, you know, I have to buy it. But my point is, you know, like, you should definitely consider all of these things, because, you know, the circumstances change, right? I think the logical thing on insurance is something that's very low probability, but very, you know, but that the consequences aren't tolerable, right? In a sense, like, you could even look at Bitcoin as almost like an insurance product. And I'll give you the use case, right? Which is, when you think about the ultra hyper adversarial use case, right? Like, it means the ultra hyper adversarial use case is that your government and your bank have both turned rogue and are now against you and are now doing malevolent things to you, right? Super low probability event. Like, when is that ever going to happen? I mean, to some extent, it depends on the country you live in, right? But, like, you know, in essence, it's low probability, but the consequences are pretty significant, right? They're significant consequences, right? So in a sense, like, that's kind of an insurance product, right? So looking at it from that lens, I think that, you know, it's an insurance product without being an insured product. So the thing that's really interesting is, what if it were an insurance product with an insurance, right? So what if you could insure things like Bitcoin, right? What if you could insure Bitcoin custody, or if you could insure, there's so many things you can insure, to be honest. You know, I mean, if there's 1,000 ways to lose cryptos, and, you know, like, I think, you know, they're all probably insurable to some degree, depending on how much premium you want to pay.
I think one of the exciting things about where we're at with the industry right now, and just to, you know, not to coin that phrase of DeFi 2.0, but this rebuild, you know, where we're going is, I think we're looking at tools in a little bit different way. Like, the first iteration of DeFi was taking TradFi premises and putting them into the blockchain, right, in one way or another. So the lending and borrowing was almost identical to how it happens in the real world, except for the fact that you had less KYC around it. You had the ability to lend against your own crypto and, you know, and draw down USDC against that, or some other US dollar derivative. And that was incredible. But what we haven't done really yet is tie that back to physical property. So when I'm looking for a property right now and buying a place, I can't get a mortgage around it. I can't take that to Aave and say, look, here's a house that's worth, you know, $1 million. I need to get some cash back from this. And I think the evolution of the space is going to be tying those real world and online assets together. I think that's going to be one evolution. And then utilizing the blockchain and these new tools that are coming out to actually evolve these premises that we've already had in the typical world, like what Amulet is doing with changing the way at how traditional insurance is done, traditional DeFi insurance is done, and now us, the evolution of that.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, one of the big interesting issues there is that whenever you're connecting so-called real-world assets to kind of on-chain activity, is you obviously kind of run into an oracle problem, right? And the oracle doesn't need to look at the asset itself and be like, yep, there's a house there, but it actually needs to look at the claim of ownership, right? Which is, you know, is the person claiming the house actually the owner of the house, right? So that becomes like a really interesting problem, which I refer to as the Brooklyn Bridge problem, right? Which is the sort of famous sale of the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, if you don't know what that is, I'm happy to sell you a Brooklyn Bridge coin, you know, for $1 million. It represents the whole bridge. You can own the whole bridge. You'll collect a lot of tolls. It'll be great. You know, obviously being funny, but yeah. So you know, to me, any kind of closing thoughts around kind of the future of DeFi insurance? You know, I think you definitely painted the vision of like the meaningful value of the next wave being built on top of things like insurable real world assets. But like, you know, any other kind of futuristic statements? Would love to kind of get your perspective.
Well, I mean, really, from our perspective, we're extremely excited about Metaverse. We're extremely excited about GameFi. We think that our evolution is really going to head towards more GameFi and being able to insure assets inside a game. So that if you're going to buy a weapon and you can lose that during the game, there is a real world loss there. You've bought that for $5. You have just lost it to another player. This is where we want to be able to come in and insure against those events happening. And what I love about those sorts of things is that we're able to take traditional world insurance and apply it in the metaverse. And it is almost like for like. People, actuaries have already worked out the danger around these certain scenarios. And I don't mean to, you know, focus just on that one use case, because I'm sure there'll be somebody in the comments that goes, well, what about this problem that they'll want me to solve? But my point is that we've got a huge opportunity here, not just in the world of DeFi, but the broader Web3 landscape, to ensure all the same verticals that we ensure in the traditional world.
I like the idea, right? Because, you know, it's kind of known that the pop singer Rihanna has insured her legs with Lloyd's of London for $1 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of an amusing thought that you can kind of start to insure, you know, various and sundry articles, you know, including one's own legs.
There's nothing you can't insure. That's for sure. But, you know, whether or not people will buy that, that's the biggest question.
It's kind of amazing, actually, right? There's certainly actors that insure their face or insure various things, but it's kind of funny, right? Because it's sort of like, okay, like the legs, but not the arms. Like the whole thing is just kind of very, it's incredibly puzzling, right? The whole thing is like
amazingly mystical. The leg, is it just below the knee? Is it like the top half as well?
Absolutely, like, right? And you can imagine, a claims adjuster kind of looking at a leg and being like, "Well, that's kind of more the hip." I'm sorry to say, like,
exactly.
You know, it looks like the car struck your leg at an angle. You know, so it's very. I'm being amusing, but you know, it's a wild world. But you know, to me, like. Absolutely, insurance is a financial primitive. You know, it sort of produces financial certainty, you know, in an uncertain physical world, a real world, right? So in a sense, like, you know, I don't think the uncertainty of the world will ever go away, you know, so I think at least we can provide financial services that, you know, at least provide financial assurance. And I think that's exceedingly valuable, right? Like people want that. And you know, I think people will always want that. And I think the world will always be uncertain. So, you know, I think eat dessert first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there, as I droned on about before, there's huge world of opportunity out there. I'm very excited to be at the forefront of it right now. And, you know, our focus is really to maintain that and stay there. And, you know, I think if we do, then the world's our oyster. There's all sorts of different primitives.
We definitely are, you know, just to touch on the current macro environment, like, you know, there is tremendous liquid dry powder venture capital in the wings, you know, including our fund, Gumi Crypto's Capital Fund 2, which we raised. And like, there are incredibly talented builders, you know, so in a sense, like we're all using this bearish sentiment to just build things that really have primary value, right? Primary value being like stuff people need and want to buy, you know, and in a sense, kind of if YOLO DeGen kind of burns off, like, yeah, fine. Like we're, you know, it's less than not a problem. It's actually good, right? It's good. It's good riddance to bad rubbish. If things can't survive sort of stress tests, they probably shouldn't be with us anyway. So, you know, we think that, I mean, obviously bearing in mind that, like, you know, there are retail investors that have been kind of badly hurt by this downturn, and that's obviously bad. You know, like it's not, this industry doesn't need that, and it, you know, but the great hope is that everybody can learn and come back smarter. You know, I think people who are sort of fully wiped out won't come back, but you know, if people can come back, and maybe next time, you know, a little less YOLO DeGen and a little more looking at like who's building what and why, a little more of like what are they building and like what problem do they solve, and like, you know, think just really, really base level fundamentals, right? Then if we have fundamentals, we can even have a derivatives market that's pretty large, right? If people are building things that others want and will pay for, right? Those are all really, really valuable insights, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, especially at this time.
Super appreciate being here. Thanks very much, Miko. And if any of the listeners have got, or the watchers have got any questions, just reach out through our Discord on amulet.org.
Fantastic. Amulet.org. So you heard it here on the Miko Bits show, and looking forward. If you have any comments, please put them below, and look forward to seeing you on the next episode. Thanks so much.
Bye.